This morning we are going to talk about a woman of God. A woman like we read about from Proverbs chapter 30. We're going to talk about Deborah. Now Deborah's story is a long story. So I've broken it into two parts. And what that means is if you'd like the end of it, you have to come back next week. But you're going to find the story of Deborah in the book of Judges. So go ahead and flip there. We're going to spend a lot of time there this morning. In the book of Judges, chapter 4. Now Deborah's faith in God, even when she was facing impossible odds, was vindicated. The Old Testament is full of characters who, for one reason or another, seemed like they were unlikely candidates for the task they were given or the honor that they got or the recognition that they received, and yet they were called by God. God likes to foil our concept of an unlikely leader. But there is nothing in what we are about to read that suggests that Deborah's gender improved or detracted from her status as a judge and a deliverer. Nor is there an indication that God had any reservations about her functioning in the role that He chose her to function in. Deborah functions as a judge. She functions as a prophet. And she functions as a very capable military leader. And the text does not minimize any of those roles because she's a woman. She was a woman, she was a wife, and she was a mother of Israel. Now that particular phrase, interestingly enough, is controversial, but we're going to get more into that phrase next week. Now, this is one of those stories where as you read about it in the text, if you don't have a map, it doesn't make much sense. And so, I've got a map, and it's got a lot of arrows. But hopefully they'll make sense as we go. If you look at the very beginning of Judges chapter 4, start in verse 4, and we're going to read, "She sent and summoned Barak, son of Abinadab, from Kadesh in Naphtali." Alright, here's Naphtali. Right up there is Kadesh. "And said to him, 'The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go and take a position at Mount Tabor.'" Here's Mount Tabor, which is a fir piece from Kadesh. "Bring 10,000 from the tribe of Naphtali and the tribe of Zebulun." So that's this little one, along with the big one where he lives. "And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the Wadi Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I'll give him into your hand." And Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." And she said, "I'll surely go with you." Now, Barak has gotten a lot of flack over the years for that commentary. But I would like to propose to you that Barak was not an ignorant man. He was one of the most capable generals that Deborah could summon. But he could, just as easily as Deborah could, look at the odds he was facing and realize that he was on the losing side. Deborah says, "Bring 10,000. Now y'all, some of y'all have worked with volunteer organizations before. Go get 10,000 volunteers on the fly. Now Barak, think this one through with me now. Barak says, "I'll tell you what, I'll go if you'll go. But if you're not going, I'm not going either." Now at this point, Deborah is an accepted judge of Israel. She's an accepted prophet of Israel. By the way, you know what happens to a prophet of Israel that's wrong? Well, that's right, you get stoned. You only get to be wrong once. Because what if you were said, "Oh, well, God said X and X didn't happen," it means you lied in God's name. And God wasn't good with that. So here's Barak's logic. If she comes with me and we lose, she's going to die too. But at this point, she's got a good reputation. And interestingly enough, Barak's words very much mirror the words of Moses Back in Exodus chapter 33, verse 15, where the Lord says, Moses, go take your people away from this place. And usually when God referred to Moses' people as Moses' people and not my people, it wasn't a good thing. And Moses said, I tell you what, Lord, I'm not going anywhere if you're not coming. If you're not coming, don't send me from here. But if you're coming, I'll go wherever you send me. Barak's words are not the words of a coward. They are words of a practical, realistic man. There are some interesting literary elements in this story. One of them, Deborah's name means bee. Now, it's a small critter that if you mess with it, can cause a lot of pain. But usually how that's translated in terms of applying to a woman is a fiery or spirited woman. But the other interesting thing about the bee is that as far as the Israelites were concerned, it was one of the more intelligent animals out there. Because they have a constant and ready division of labor so they can get very large projects done. It also speaks of Deborah's intelligence. And then we have Barak. Now his name translates to lightning. And there may be some irony here. Or it may be that this is referring to the terrible storm that the Lord is going to send to ensure Barak's victory here. Sisera is not a Semitic name, which means it doesn't readily translate into some other image or picture. But we know that he was one of the sea peoples, that he was a skilled military man, and that he was feared. Now, Deborah's story has four parts, and we're only going to cover two of them this morning. But the first one is very much a David and Goliath situation, which is kind of interesting, because David and Goliath aren't going to come for a good while yet, but we're going to refer backwards to her situation as David and Goliath's situation. If you look in Judges 4, 1 through 11, you find out that Deborah is a prophetess, a speaker of wisdom, but when war came, she led the outnumbered, badly equipped Israelite troops to a great victory. And she chose the best military general that she could get a hold of. Now, if you keep going down into verse 12 from chapter 4, you'll see that Deborah manages to maneuver an overconfident enemy into driving iron-wheeled chariots into a marshland where they bog down. Then the Israelite slingmen and archers picked them off once they were sunk in the mud. And the enemy forces were routed, their troops were slaughtered, the Israelites were jubilant, and Sisera runs like a coward. He abandons his troops as they're being slaughtered. And he runs toward the encampment of Jael, who is a Kenite. And we're going to get more into her next week. But one of the things you need to understand about Deborah's story is it's very much a story about trust in God. It was not a story about trust in Israelite forces. The Israelites put their faith in God, and in turn, God helped them defeat a seemingly invincible army, and they gained some pretty valuable territory. The battle and their victory gave the Israelite tribes their first access to some fertile and prosperous plains of Jezreel. Now, right now, at this point in history, when Deborah comes along, we're looking at about 1125 BC. And they're living in the hill countries. All this land here is the plain of Jezreel. It's good farmland even today. And the Israelites wanted it then. This story ridicules the Canaanite army because they were being beaten by a woman. And that was, of course, a shameful way to die. And it was shameful for their leaders who had been stung by this holy woman of God. The story, interestingly enough, shows up twice, once in chapter 5 and once in chapter 4. But what's in chapter 5 is called the Song of Deborah. It's a poem. And what's in chapter 4 is the narrative version, and it's less complete than the song is. Scholars tell us that the poem showed up first, and then they wrote a narrative about it later. Let's see. There are some things that we need to know about judges just in general, and then Deborah specifically. But by and large, judges are not really good role models. Jephthah kills his own daughter. Samson likes to consort with prostitutes. Gideon leads the people into idolatry. Deborah stands out for a couple of reasons. First of all, she's the only woman in the whole list. Second, for her wisdom, for her courage, and her faith all the way through the story. None of the other judges meet those criteria. When Deborah was a judge, the word judge didn't mean then what it means now. A judge in Israel was a tribal leader who, in times of peace, had the authority to settle disputes and problems. In times of war, a judge acted as a rallying point to gather the tribes and organize resistance. The people of Deborah's time had no difficulty accepting her as a judge, which is a fascinating thing. It suggests that perhaps judges were seen as God's people, and as a result, their gender was not all that important. What we see, if we look back in Judges chapter 4, verse 1, is at the time, Deborah, a prophetess, wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites came up to her for judgment. Her territory is pretty significant. The very next judge that we're going to get that follows this approximately Deborah's lead here is Samuel. And it's very interesting how many similarities there are between the route that Samuel takes on his circuit and Deborah. Deborah is introduced to us as a prophet. Now, a prophet is somebody who heard a message from God and passed it on to his people. And often the message was about staying apart from the surrounding cultures, maintaining a unique identity as an Israelite. Deborah sat under her special palm tree in the hill country of Ephraim and gave her judgment on particular matters. Now, where she sat there was equivalent to her courthouse. It was a place where people went when they needed a dispute settled. She was inspired to speak about the deteriorating state of the country around Ephraim. Law and order had broken down. It was no longer safe to travel on the highways, which, when you read the text all the way through, what it says is people are going through the winding ways, and what that means is they're sneaking through the woods because it wasn't safe to walk the highway. If you're going to walk the highway, you're going to get robbed, definitely. If you snuck through the woods, you at least had a chance of making it. Now, secular history tells us that the Israelite settlers really weren't helping their own cause because, of course, they had the hill country. And what they were doing is they were raiding the plains that the Canaanites owned. And as they raided Canaanite farms on the plains, it made the city-states that actually owned the plains angry. And so then those city-states came to retaliate, and thus the Israelites considered themselves oppressed. Now, the Canaanites were led by King Jabin of Hazor. Jabin ruled a large, fortified city-state in Upper Canaan. Now, that much we know, not only biblically, but through secular history, that's established. But there is speculation, given how this story unfolds and where Sisera lives in relationship to where Jabin lives, that Jabin was actually a commander of a confederation of city-states. And his aim was to restore Canaan's power by just exterminating the Israelite invaders. So, we got this situation set up. The Canaanites are annoyed, and they're about to go wipe out the Israelites because they're tired of their farms being raided. So, at the threat of the might of King Jabin's army, the Israelites turn to Deborah. She summons Barak, who's a capable military leader, and she spoke very directly to him. That's one of the things I find interesting is that Deborah does not command Barak. What she said is, "The Lord commanded you to do X." And apparently, she seems to be reminding him that he's had a command. He goes to Mount Tabor with as many fighting men as he can assemble to draw King Jabin out with his fearsome general Sisera, and they want him at the Wadi of Kishon. Now, this is actually kind of interesting. This is the river Kishon. The Wadi is an area that floods when the river overflows its banks. The Wadi incorporates all of this area and the plain out here. Now that's going to be relevant in a minute. But at first, Barak is reluctant to enter into battle against Sisera. His hesitation is not all that surprising because the Canaanites possess vastly superior military technology. Sisera has a standing, disciplined, professional army, and his troops are armed to the teeth with iron weapons and chariots. And if you look in Judges chapter 5, verse 8, it says, "Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 Israelites." Well, that doesn't take very much math. You know, I'm not good at math, but they've only got 10,000 Israelites, not 40,000. So in 10,000 Israelites, if only 40,000 of them have a spear, there's a good chance that all you got is clubs in 10,000 dudes going against spears and chariots. The odds are not looking good. Now, Barak has this citizen militia from most of the 12 tribes, though some of the tribes ignored Deborah's summons, and we're going to get into that next week, because she's not happy with them. And they will be sorry that she is not happy with them. But, so Barak knew that he was outnumbered, he was out-equipped, he had an untrained, inferior army, and against those odds, right now the odds, again, we have to appeal to secular history, but it looks like Sisera has a standing army of about 100,000. 10-1 odds is not good odds. It's not looking good for Barak. So when you look at his reluctance to go take on Sisera head first, it seems more like common sense than fear on Barak's part, because he didn't want to enter a battle that he clearly couldn't win. But there are people in history who manage to inspire loyalty in the people around them, and then they achieve things that seemed impossible. Sometimes those are military leaders, and sometimes those are government leaders. But Deborah seems to have been one of these people. She had the charisma necessary to convince people to take an extraordinary risk and succeed. The force of her personality and her faith in God gave Barak the courage to face the odds that he knew were overwhelming. Now, Deborah's army, led by Barak, assembled at Mount Tabor, a brave but motley force. And you have to understand that these people were summoned as volunteers. There is no standing army in pre-monarchic Israel. That doesn't happen until you get to Saul a lot later. So, we have the Canaanite army that shows up in heavy wheeled chariots. He has 900 of them. These chariots are heavy. And what you could do is just run those horses with that heavy chariot right through the opposing army and just take mow down wide swaths of them. So their weight and velocity plowed massive furrows through your enemies, and they're scary. The Canaanites had the technology to build that sort of military equipment. The Israelites didn't. They were poorly equipped, and they were pitted against magnificent chariots. And all they had really going for them was their faith in God. And if you look down in Judges chapter 4, verse 12, you see Deborah, who says to Barak, "Up, for this is the day on which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. The Lord is indeed going out before you." And so Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 warriors following him. And the Lord threw Sisera and his chariots and all his army into a panic before Barak. Where's Barak and his army? They've got the high ground, yes? They're on Mount Tabor. Now, statistically, the Canaanites should have won that battle pretty easily. But they did not. See, there was a tremendous rainstorm. And the 900 chariots that are meant for quick maneuvering on firm ground got bogged down in the mud. And just before the battle, this flash flood swelled the nearby Wadi Kishon and turned the battlefield into deep mud, which gave the Israelite foot soldiers the advantage because they're standing on dry ground on Mount Tabor. This is a picture of a wagon in World War I stuck in the mud. I don't know if you guys, some of you guys are from up north, you've seen mud like this. We don't have mud like this in Florida. It is amazing, the sticking capacity of that mud. You'll notice that this poor mule over here, he's up to his chest in that mud. And bless his heart, he's not pulling a wagon, he's trying to keep his head above the mud. Imagine 900 of those stuck in the mud because of a flash flood. Now, while the chariots are stuck in the mud, you've got the Israelites with their archers and with their slings picking Canaanites off. Now, there's a lot of irony in this story because the main god of the Canaanites was Baal. And he was a god of storms, a god of the weather, and he was worshipped by the Canaanites, but the Canaanites lost this battle because of the storm. Now the Israelites, they're stoked, they're elated, because their god is clearly superior to the god of the Canaanites. So, abandoning his army, Sisera runs. His problem is that he runs toward an encampment of Kenites, and we're going to learn more about them next week. Here's the battleground. Sisera starts running this way, which is kind of funny since his home is this way. But he's running the other way. So what we have is this extraordinary woman, Deborah, a prophetess, a judge, who sits under her palm tree in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelite people come to her for judgment. And under God's inspiration, she does this fascinating, marvelous thing. She takes command of the Israelite people, convinces them to fight a bigger, better equipped Canaanite army, which was led by a terrifying Canaanite general. And the general that Deborah appointed was really none too enthusiastic about his task, because he was a sensible fellow, and he saw that he was outmatched. But Deborah was able to convince him that he could win if he would only rely on God. And when the time came, God indeed stood by the Israelites. This drenching storm made the flat land of the battlefield a quagmire, and those iron-wheeled chariots became bogged in the mud, making the Canaanite soldiers easy targets for the Israelite archers and slingmen. It is clear that God chose Deborah from among his rebellious people to accomplish his will. She responded to her calling, and that battle was secured. Barak recognized her authority from God and obeyed her instructions. Now, interestingly enough, go back and read the text. Her instructions are, remember what God has already told you. Deborah is not commanding Barak. Deborah is telling Barak to remember what God's already said to him. The Song of Deborah in chapter 5 praises God. She praises herself a tad bit too. And she praises Barak. And she praises some other folk that we'll get into next week. But it was because of their obedience to God that they won this battle. However, the battle is won. The army is on the run. But this story is only half over. But you will have to come back next week for the exciting conclusion of Deborah, a woman of God. Now, at this time, we like to provide an opportunity for people to come forward and request baptism or prayers of the church. which you may do as we stand and as together we sing.